All right, lex talionis. What about this principle in the Old Testament which says that we should get an eye for an eye? What about lex talionis? If you pluck out my eye, I get to come back and pluck out your eye. Doesn't that contradict what Jesus taught in the New Covenant, that we're supposed to forgive our enemies, not go back and get eye for an eye, retribution? Well, lex talionis is Latin. It literally means the law of retaliation. It comes from a number of places in the Old Testament, one of which is Exodus 21:23, where we read, "But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise." Could they be any more explicit? You pluck out my eye, I'm getting that eye back. You know, there's that play by William Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice. Al Pacino plays Shylock in the movie. What a great actor. Shylock is a Jewish money lender, and he lends money to this character Antonio in the play. And it was back during times where anti-Semitism was in its height. Of course, Shylock is a Jewish money lender passing it out. So there was some racism there. But he passes out this money to Antonio. And he says, "What are you going to give me if you don't pay back this debt?" And Antonio says, "Well, I'll give you a pound of my flesh." Well, he goes belly up. He can't pay back the money. And so for the rest of the play, Shylock goes around with a knife trying to hunk a pound of his flesh out of his side. It's pretty disgusting. Well, people wonder if that's what's going on here in the Old Testament. You know, if you plucked out my eye, would the governing authorities pin you down? I'd pull out a knife or a spoon or whatever, and I would just go to town on your eyeball. Well, that's not the case. This law was never meant to be literal. It's not a literal command. In fact, Leviticus 19:18 says that the Jews were not to take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You know, the idea of loving your neighbor as yourself is not a New Testament invention. It's an Old Testament one. In fact, in the context of this verse, in verse 26, we read that a servant could go free if injured. So if a servant was hurt, they could use that as leverage to gain their freedom from their master. In other words, they wouldn't have to go back and do an eye for an eye. And in other cases, like in verse 30, in the immediate context of this law, it says that a ransom was given for damage. So if you hurt me, in other words, I could ask you to pay that back. I wouldn't go back and try and literally get your eye. So we could say that this was meant for protection, not for revenge. We're just fundamentally misinterpreting the passage if we think that it was about revenge. The Old Testament teaches that we shouldn't be into revenge. Instead, this was not for the offender. It was for the offended. If you hurt me, it helps protect me as a person who is offended. So it probably looked something like this. "Dude, you plucked out my eye. I have one eye right now." And the offender would say, okay, $50. Not cutting it. Give me that eye. I want that eye. All right. Okay. $100. My eye's worth more than $100. Give me your eye. I'll take your eye. Okay. $1,000. Okay. I'll take $1,000. You don't have to give me your eye. So what it was it encouraged fair bargaining. If the person wouldn't pay up, if they wouldn't make the ransom, then at that point you could say, "Well, if you don't think that's fair, give me your eyeball." Oh, okay. All right. Now I'll actually pay what I think would be fair. And it encouraged fair bargaining. When we compare this with the code of Hammurabi, we see that they practice this same thing, lex talionis, eye for an eye, much differently. They didn't practice it for the aristocrats and the wealthy. If a wealthy person hurt somebody, it was like, whatever, I'm rich, get off my case. You took my eye, so what? Doesn't matter, I'm rich and wealthy. If you were in the upper class, you didn't have to adhere to this moral principle to the proletariat. They were just slaves and serfs. Moreover, if a builder killed your kid, let's say you were constructing a house and you accidentally didn't build the foundation right and 2x4 or something came over and killed that person's kid or the house collapsed. Lex Talionis in the Code of Hammurabi stated that you would go back and kill that person's kid. In Deuteronomy 24:16, we see that's completely different. There is no such thing as taking it out on the person's family if an accident happened. Entirely different. Okay, what about slavery in the Old Testament? Many people look at the subject of slavery in the Old Testament as one of the reasons why we had slavery in the South. Below the Mason-Dixon line in the 18th and 19th centuries. Well, we have to ask ourselves, is Old Testament slavery similar to slavery in the antebellum South, pre-war South? Well, what we find is that it's actually not similar whatsoever. In fact, slavery is really a misnomer, as you'll see, as we unpack what slavery actually looked like in the Old Testament. They should have called it servanthood. That's what it really was. It was. Let's just read the scripture and you'll see for yourself. Slavery in the antebellum South before the Civil War is nothing like slavery in the Hebrew Bible. For one, citizens of Israel sold themselves as servants voluntarily. Why? Due to poverty. There was no such thing as filing bankruptcy at this time. You didn't have chapter 9 or whatever, where you just filed bankruptcy and couldn't pay your debts. If you came into debt, if you were destitute, you had to sell yourself as a servant to pay off that debt. So slavery was voluntary. We read in Leviticus 25, if the countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you. No, it was not that you went and grabbed someone and made them a slave. It was voluntary. You shall not subject him to a slave servant's service. He shall be with you as a hired man. It was really servanthood, being a hired man in the society. Second, the debts were released every 7 years. So the person sold themselves voluntarily because of poverty, and the slate was wiped clean every 7 years. You should just read through the entirety of Deuteronomy 15. I'm just going to take excerpts from it here. Verse 1 says, at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a remission of debts. This is the manner of remission. Every creditor shall release what he has loaned to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor and his brother because the Lord's remission has been proclaimed. Could you imagine that? Every loan that was out after 7 years was wiped clean. Verse 7, if there is a poor man with you, one of your brothers in any of your towns in your land, which the Lord your God has given you, you shall not harden your heart nor close your hand from your poor brother, but you shall freely open your hand to him and shall generously lend him sufficient for his need and whatever he lacks. If someone's poor and needy, you're supposed to lend him money. Verse 12, if your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, then again, case law, if this happens, this is what you should do. Then he shall serve you 6 years, but in the seventh year you shall set him free. When you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. Now imagine if this law was actually practiced in the period of the Civil War. No one could be involuntarily made a slave. They could only be a servant for 7 years. And after you released them, you had to put some money in their pocket on the way out the door. It wasn't that they were enforcing the Bible, it's that they weren't enforcing it enough compared to the brutality in our country, in the modern era. Verse 14, you shall furnish him liberally from your flock and from your threshing floor and from your wine vat. You shall give him as the Lord your God has blessed you. Verse 15, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I'm commanding you this day. In other words, God's saying, you remember you guys were slaves under the Egyptians, right? Yeah, don't mistreat slaves. You should actually take care of them. So the ideal in Israel was no poverty. Okay, but if one of your kinsmen, if one of your fellow citizens fell into poverty and they're sold to you, this is what you should do. They should work off their debt. And yet the Jews were supposed to be empathetic to slaves. Thirdly, servants could voluntarily stay on with their master. If somebody was destitute, came into a family that they liked, after 7 years, they could renew their contract and stay. This is in Deuteronomy 15:16. It shall come about if he says to you, I will not go out from you, because he loves you and your household, since he fares well with you. Then you shall take an awl and a pierce and pierce through his ear into the door, and he shall be your servant forever. He's supposed to pierce his ear at that point. And that's a symbol that this person's part of our family. Fourth, the poor were given free food, what we might call welfare, to survive in ancient Israel. If you ever read through the book of Ruth, you see that. Ruth was a Moabitess, came from a different land, not Jewish, not a citizen of Israel. And the farmers had their real estate, and they're commanded in the Bible to leave some of the extra stuff around the side of the farm so that when the destitute came through, like Ruth, they could pick up some of the food and take it back and they could survive. So you didn't even have to get into slavery, pledge yourself as a servant, because you could go through and get free food. Fifth, the poor weren't charged interest on loans. Did you know that the Bible teaches that? When you lend to other people, you're not supposed to have interest on loans. You know, if you drive through poorer neighborhoods, one of the things you see just about on every block are the check cashing buildings. That's where they encourage people, poor people, to bring their paycheck, because they're living paycheck to paycheck. They can't pay for groceries or rent this week. And so they'll say, yeah, you can bring your check in here and we'll cash that for you, but we're going to take, you know, 20% of that. So it's a way to actually keep people in the cycle of poverty. That's in our modern society. Okay, we think that that's normal. In ancient Israel, you weren't allowed to do this. You weren't allowed to charge any interest on loans. Exodus 22:25. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. Six, kidnapping a man and selling him into slavery was a capital crime. It's not only that the Bible says servanthood or slavery should be voluntary. It says the opposite of that. It says if anyone kidnaps someone and forces them into slavery, you should be put to death. Now, again, let's apply this rule to slavery in the antebellum South. It wasn't that they were enforcing the Bible too much. It's that they were enforcing it too little. Exodus 21:16. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. So whether you grab him and make him your slave, or you capture him and sell him off, you're going to be put to death under this legal code. Seventh, families were commanded to harbor runaway slaves in ancient Israel. Deuteronomy 23:15. You shall not hand over to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall live with you in your midst in the place which he shall choose, in one of your towns where it pleases him. You shall not mistreat him. Now, this is very different from the ancient Near East. Here's what Paul Copan writes. This is from his book, Is God a Moral Monster? He says, Hammurabi even demanded the death penalty for those helping runaway slaves. The surrounding cultures were opposite. If you helped a runaway slave, that warranted death. And yet in ancient Israel, you were supposed to help runaway slaves. Eighth, masters and servants had the same master. Now, this is also unique to ancient Israel. According to biblical thought, we are all made in the image of God, Genesis 1:26 and 27. Therefore, to kill someone or to hurt someone made in the image of God was a terrible offense. Read Genesis 9. People made in the image of God had moral value, no matter who they were. Here's the way Job describes it. In Job 31, it says, if I had despised the claim of my male or female slaves when they filed a complaint against me, what then could I do when God arises and when he calls me to account? What will I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him, and the same one fashion us in the womb? First of all, he says, God's going to call me to an account for the way I've treated these people. And he says, you know, God's actually made all of us. We're all made in his image. Ninth, if a master injured a slave, they had to release him. Now, think about how different that was, even from modern slavery going on in the world today. We read in Exodus 21:26, if a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. And if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. So So if somebody was damaged by a household, they could actually pull out this law and say, I want to go free. Their debt is completely wiped clean. Moreover, 10, abusive masters received punishment. Abusive masters received punishment. Exodus 21, verse 20, if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. So in other words, you could see that these laws are not there to promote slavery. They were there to protect the slaves. They weren't, God was setting up boundaries for these people. Okay, well then someone will ask, well, what about slavery in the New Testament? Doesn't Colossians 3 and Ephesians 5 and a number of other passages support the notion of slavery? That slaves ought to obey their masters? Well, the first thing we could point out is that those passages are all written by Jews who believed in the Old Testament law. So right off the bat, what we're seeing there is an entirely civilized form of servanthood, not slavery like we think in our context. But in addition to that, we can make a few more points. First, the context in which the New Testament letters were written was the context of the Roman Empire. In the Roman Empire, it has been estimated that roughly one-third of the people were slaves. Now, there were other slave revolts, and when people revolted, Rome would come in, and they would smash them down, they would rape, pillage, and murder, and completely decimate any kind of a revolt. It's not as though if the New Testament authors said we should get rid of slavery, that all of a sudden Emperor Nero would say, wow, well, we should stop having all these people being slaves. Instead, what we find in the New Testament is that the New Testament authors are appealing to both the slaves and the slave masters, which was unheard of, both appealing to them as people made in the image of God. In fact, the New Testament taught equality. Galatians 3:28, whether Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female, we are all one in Christ Jesus. And there's a number of other passages which teach the same thing. In other words, Christianity formed a worldview foundation which eventually toppled the concept of slavery. Even though there were Christians who used, or I should say misused, the Bible to promote slavery, it was also Christians such as William Wilberforce in Britain who almost single-handedly brought down slavery in the British Empire. One author refers to it as econocide. Econocide. Suicides where you kill yourself. Econocides where you kill your economy, okay? William Wilberforce stood up to his parliament and said, we should stop doing the slave trade because God has made these people in his image. And people at the time were not happy about that. There was so much free labor that it was thought of as insane to not dominate other people. And yet Christianity served as a worldview foundation that eventually toppled slavery. You know, when you think about it, there has never been any culture or really any worldview that has had a problem with slavery. Okay, there's one culture, the slaves. Okay, they've had a problem with slavery. Other worldviews have never had an issue with it. Aristotelian thought didn't have a problem with it. That's secular thinking, Aristotle. Aristotle reasoned that if you were stronger, if you were more powerful, that you should dominate women, slaves. They're your property. They're not persons. Nietzsche didn't have a problem with it. Morality comes from the end of a gun under a secular worldview. At least in the Christian worldview, we had a foundation for toppling slavery, albeit way later than it should have been undermined. And then finally, thirdly, Paul taught that slaves should get their freedom if possible. 1 Corinthians 7:21. If you're a slave, you should get your freedom. There was just one problem with that. They couldn't. Okay. They were slaves. These were written in an actual historical context, and people couldn't get their freedom if they wanted it. And yet the Bible does affirm slaves should be freed from slavery.